Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. We look at the surreptitious effort to impeach President Trump.
This process of doing these interviews behind closed doors and the selective leaking that goes with it is entirely inappropriate.
And the reasons why.
They're all concerned if they don't impeach him, he's going to get reelected.
Trump takes down a pair of ISIS leaders.
He expressed to his national security team his determination to want to get this target.
Later, an entertaining look at the Prager Corolla film, No Safe Spaces.
Your mother does not have a big picture of you up in the house, I assume.
I don't think she has a picture of me in her head.
And Dennis explains what's behind the film.
This movie will give people hope.
I'm Seth Leibson, in for the vacationing Hugh Hewitt. Catch my program each weekday afternoon from 3 to 6 on 960 The Patriot out of Phoenix, Arizona. Go to 960thepatriot.com to listen live. Take a moment and give me a follow on Twitter, at Seth Leibson. That's L-E-I-B-S-O-H-N. Great to be with you. Midweek, Democrats finally unveiled the text of the resolutions on procedures for public hearings on the impeachment of President Donald Trump. As it is, Democrats have carefully managed the impeachment, keeping key witnesses behind closed doors and leaking only what they want the public to see and hear. Elite media has played along beautifully. I discussed this topic with former U.S. Attorney Andrew McCarthy. We have been in a defense mode that is characterized mostly by the process of impeachment. And that's going to wear pretty thin pretty soon once things start coming out, and they probably will start coming out. So you're saying that the White House, the administration, the president's defenders, they just need to forget this process argument for the time being and just get to the merits and talk about how none of this is even close to impeachable.
Yeah, that's what I think, Seth. I think eventually they're going to have to take on the allegations and rebut them. Process arguments, I say as a former litigator who's kind of nerdy about process, they really don't resonate with the public. And even in the law, as I mentioned in this piece, I've tried to refute Adam Schiff's claim that this process of doing these interviews behind closed doors and the selective leaking that goes with it is entirely inappropriate. His claim that it's analogous to a grand jury, I think, fails on a variety of different grounds. But the one place where I think I have some sympathy for it, not that this is an argument that he's pushed much, is that it's kind of black letter law that if a person ultimately has a full and fair public trial where he gets all the rights that the Constitution provides, and the right to present a defense and confront the witnesses and all that jazz. If you get that, a court is never going to throw out a case or reverse the conviction because things went wrong in the grand jury.
Right.
Well, because there was prosecutorial misconduct in the grand jury.
Right.
So, you know, this idea that the Republicans I've heard for the last 2 days running with the idea that this was botched from the beginning, as Kevin McCarthy
said. The sun ringing of the bell business, right.
Yeah, and they're trying to make this like fruit of the poisonous tree argument.
Yeah.
And these are arguments that wouldn't even work in a legal proceeding.
Okay.
And this isn't a legal proceeding. This is a political issue. It's impeachment. So I think they got to get to the merit.
And I hope they do. Let me just play slight devil's advocate for a half a moment with you on this, because I've contended, and you could agree or disagree, I've contended that, you know, despite partisan affiliations, one thing I think that most Americans do get is fundamental fairness and fundamental unfairness.
Yep.
And I think to the degree that they appeal on that, there's some merit. On the other hand, this is going to go forward. And I think in your column over the weekend, I think it was, you laid out about 9 strong defenses of what has allegedly taken place here as not being impeachable offenses. And it is hard, I think, to focus the American mind on the debate about what is a high crime and misdemeanor. That's, I think, what they would say. I think they would say that.
Nonetheless, that's where we're going. Yeah, let me agree with you, Seth, to a large extent in this way. If the way this process worked It was in and what I'm talking now is about the House process of returning articles of impeachment or voting, you know, ultimately articles of impeachment.
Sure.
If the way the whole process worked was to do it all behind closed doors, and at the end they spat out a document that had two or three articles of impeachment and then voted on it,
right?
I would entirely agree with you.
Right.
What I'm anticipating is we're now at the public phase where they're going to have public hearings leading to articles of impeachment. And I must say, I think the way this has been done, I say this with regret, not because I endorse it, because I hate that this worked. But what they did here was do this stuff behind closed doors, selectively leak it to their friendly media, which had this narrative ready to go. And it has moved public opinion in their direction. The polls have changed.
Yeah.
So now they feel safe going overt. It's not. It's wrong that it, that they've done it this way.
Yeah, but they shaped the mind. They politically and cleverly shaped the mind. As we all know, impeachment talk began before Trump was even inaugurated, and it became a hot topic heading into the 2018 primaries. Salem host Mike Gallagher addressed what is really behind this long-running effort to impeach.
Speaking of drama, intrigue, the Democrats releasing their impeachment statement, or whatever you want to call it, their resolution. It's just junk. It's garbage. It gives Schiff more power. It just reinforces the power Schiff already has. It's all noise right now. It doesn't impeach him. Get it over with. The Democrats have dragged us through enough mud. We're all dirty. Now we need to get hosed off. We need to get a shower, get the impeachment out of the way. The Senate will acquit him, and presumably Trump will become the same kind of political rock star that Bill Clinton is, because that's what happened to Bill Clinton. That's what happened there. House Republicans impeached him. Senate Democrats acquitted him. Nothing to see here. Total vindication, they say. Now he's a rock star, I guess. So I guess that's what's going to happen to Trump, right? You hear every day. Every day I start every hour.
I'm concerned that if we don't impeach this president, he will get reelected.
Yeah, they're all concerned. If they don't impeach him, he's going to get reelected. What do you think they're telling us? Pelosi has said as much, too. Oh, we just can't let him get reelected. We can't. We can't trust the American people. Again, look what happened in 2016. We trusted the American people, and they elected the wrong person. We can't do it again. So we better stop him. It's as obvious as Epstein's suicide reports. You know, when something quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. They're trying desperately to say that the president isn't allowed to ask the president of Ukraine to investigate shenanigans. He's allowed to do that. It's not a removable, impeachable offense. Let the Democrats run with it. Make fools of themselves. Do the damage they're trying to do. I mean, when you say, well, wait a minute, Gallagher, if they can't get a conviction in the Senate, and they won't, why are they doing it? The great Brit Hume had a terrific answer, cut number 11 from Tucker Carlson tonight on Fox News Channel.
If a president impeached, is the president to some extent tarnished and embarrassed?
Yes.
So if they can't get him removed, they can at least touch him up a bit in the hope that that will contribute to his not being reelected.
Right.
That's clearly what's in play here. And, you know, the president clearly doesn't want this. He said as much publicly. He didn't
want
to be impeached. No president would want to be impeached. So this is something they have the power to do. The question is whether they can do so and at the same time protect Democrats in the House, whose districts were carried by Mr. Trump, from being damaged politically by the impeachment, which will not go down well in those districts, one presumes, and whether then they have any hope of getting his impeachment affirmed, that is to say, by conviction in the Senate. Everybody says it's clear that the Senate will not do this. I think it's very unlikely the Senate would do this. After all, the president only there are 53 Republicans in the Senate. The president can lose 19 of them,
yes.
19, and still survive in office.
And it's just not going to happen. He's not going to be removed from office. They all know it.
Almost lost in this obsession with impeachment, United States' special forces took out the leaders of ISIS in a series of very successful attacks overseas. Retired four-star General Jack Keane discussed the president's determination to rid our world of this kind of evil while with Kevin McCullough from AM 970, The Answer in New York City.
General, it's a good day, no? ISIS terrorists are being killed and are on the run, and it's a very bad day for them. That's a good day for the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Great thing for America, you know, writ large, for the world itself. Certainly a brilliant operation that was conducted in Idlib province by our special operations folks. And the promise of these other targets, I think we likely had these targets ahead of the Baghdadi target, but we probably did not want to trigger them and spook Baghdadi. So
right.
The fact that we're doing them right on the heels of it, I think is very telling.
Are we also getting in these potential raids and follow-ups, are we also gaining more information from those sites that are going to help us to get more if we act fast enough?
Yeah, when you're moving on a target that is at a headquarters or a facility as opposed to somebody going down the road, which would be more susceptible to use a drone on it, the mission is usually capture and kill. And the kill depends on what's taking place at the target. You want to put forces on the ground then, because you really have an opportunity. I know they did want to capture Baghdadi, if they could, and for all the obvious interrogation gain that comes from that. You know, we found that the higher up these guys are in the Radical Islamic Organization, the more they talk. And most of them, at the end of the day, are moral cowards. Secondly, as you suggest, when you're dealing with a complex for the leader of a major organization like this, he, by definition, will have much information there to help him do what he needs to do in terms of running his organization. So that's clearly, we'll reap the benefit of that, much as we did after the Osama bin Laden raid. So that's all very good. And listen, there's a lot of credit to go around here. Certainly the courage and daring of our special ops pilots and the operators who were on the ground. But our intelligence service did a masterful job here in continuing to pursue this target. And also our allies and partners. We've got Iraqi interrogators who gained valuable information from key people in their detention center that helped provide the general location to Baghdadi. We've got the Syrian Democratic Forces who are supporting us and giving us information as well. And so a lot of credit here, and not the least of which is to the president, because he expressed to his national security team many times his determination to want to get this target. And he was constantly in the pursuit of that. And that's not lost on the community out there when you're toiling away 24/7 trying to find a target. At times you have a sense of futility about it. But when you got the President of the United States dogging you about it, that certainly helps a lot.
Coming up, things get crazy when you put Dennis Prager and Adam Carolla in the same room.
Your mother does not have a big picture of you up in the house, I assume.
I don't think she has a picture of me in her head.
Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership program offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Seth Leibson, filling in this week. Salem host Dennis Prager and comedian Adam Carolla are the focus of a documentary titled No Safe Spaces that looks at the zany political correctness of our culture today. It opened last week on one screen and pulled in an impressive $45,000. Prager and Carolla chatted recently on The Dennis Prager Show.
So the film is out today. I think it's a terrific film, and it is better than what I expected. Is that allowable to say, Adam?
Yeah, and I think we both feel that way because, well, first off, it's so good that it statistically has to be better than we thought it was going to be, because you and I have medium to low self-esteem, right? So in our world, we can't be involved with anything above a 7. And this thing happens to be a 10.
No. This is very funny. So they're laughing because you think we have high self-esteem, totally understandably. And I think at this point, I think it's fair to say, I think we have healthy self-esteem at this point, but we were not raised with it. We're living examples of not being raised with, I'm wonderful. I was not told once I was wonderful in my upbringing. just for the record. He was probably told he was awful. He had it. I think he had it worse.
You would, that would suggest an exchange of dialogue.
Oh, I see. That's a good point. Yeah.
We didn't have that.
Right.
I'll tell you a funny story about how low the self-esteem of the Corollas are. And it's 100% true. My mom walked in my front door about 15 years ago. She had a VHS tape that she would tape Oprah with. And she walked in and she said, "Have you heard of this comedian named Jon Stewart?" And I said, "Yes, I've heard of him." And I didn't say anything else. Well, Jon Stewart and I have the same agent. And I was friendly with the guy. I'd gone out to dinner with him. I'd been on his show a number of times. I go way back. And she said, "Oh, I think he's so wonderful. He's fantastic. I really want to show you this tape. I'm in love with this guy." And at some point, my wife couldn't contain herself anymore. And she jumped in and she said to my mom, "You know, not only does Adam know Jon Stewart, they're friendly and they have the same agent." And my mom paused and said, He's a little hit and miss."
Oh, God.
And we never watched the tape. And later on, when I saw Jon Stewart, I said, "Sorry, I cost you a fan. My mom was a huge fan of yours until she found out we were friends.
Together, right?
And then I ruined it for her. Because how could he be good and friends with her son?"
So here's my story on this. It was not to the extent of his. I want to make that clear in the memory of my parents. I began lecturing at 21. I have a very strange life. So at about the age of 23, I remember my mother saying, "Are you being paid to lecture?" And I said, "Yes." I mean, I was getting $35, but I was being paid. And she said, "Really?" I said, "Yes." Then she thought for a moment, said, "Huh. I can listen to you for free and I don't." That's Corolla-like.
Oh, yeah. You better hope my mom never becomes a fan of yours, because I'm going to ruin that lickety-split.
By the way, I want you to know, not only was I not hurt by what my mother said, I thought it was hilarious. I really did. She actually went up in my... I love my mother and all that, but... By that time, I see where it does differ is once I really was successful, my mother was thrilled. And you know, my mother had a picture of me in her house, which was the size of a wall. It was embarrassing for me to enter my mother's house. It was sort of like a shrine. But you would not have that. Your mother does not have a big picture of you up in the house, I assume.
I don't think she has a picture of me in her head. Forget about her wallet.
I invited Dennis to my own program later in the week. We discussed the film No Safe Spaces. The underlying theme, which is really to me the greatest of tragedies here, it's of course the loss of free speech is its own thing, but the loss of actual education of hundreds of thousands, millions of students every year who can't be exposed to alternative ideas, which once upon a time would be called critical thinking or intellectual curiosity, because children are naturally intellectually curious and teachers are keeping them from that curiosity and intellectual development. That to me is the tragedy here.
Yes, it's one of many. You know what? I'm starting a movement. I just started it this week, as it were.
Sign me
up. I want people to no longer call higher education, but to call it what it is, higher indoctrination.
Perfect. Sign me up. Let me be a charter member of that movement, Dennis.
You're on.
The other part of the movie that people have resonated to equally so and as much, it's an Adam Carolla part, so, you know, we're very egalitarian here. And it's that testimony, the end of his testimony in Congress, where he talks about children and gravity and about the bubble wrap we keep them in so that they will never grow into real adults.
That's right. Good stuff, huh?
It's amazingly important stuff. And what's amazing to me is the thirst that there is for it shows you the absence
of why more people aren't doing it. You make a point in the movie, I've heard you before, the ACLU isn't what the ACLU was once upon a time. You know, the reason Nadine Strossen and Alan Dershowitz are no longer with the ACLU is because they're no longer for free speech, right?
Nadine Strossen was the head of the ACLU.
Right,
right.
And they left it because they just stopped thinking that free speech was important.
Because they are liberals, not leftists.
Right.
And this is the most important distinction. If only if liberals understood what Dershowitz and Strassel understand, if they understood that liberalism has been hijacked by leftism, then the country would be saved. It's really in liberals' hands to save the country from the left.
Dennis, I agree with that. Only the liberals can, as Nixon, right, would go to China, so to speak. But let me ask you this.
Exactly.
As you have gone around the country, what is it the audience members have asked you most often about this movie or about your experience in making the No Safe Spaces movie and the project? What is it you have found across the country most people are resonant to? I told you what Phoenix was resonant to.
Well, the okay, here it goes. The most frequent question is there hope?
Yeah, right. And what do you tell them? I like what you say often on your radio show, which is, you know, at this point in our lives, the most irrelevant thing someone can tell me probably after their race is whether they have a college education. So that says something about hope, I suppose, but I don't want to presume your answer.
No. That's entirely accurate. And then the answer is there is hope, but it comes with an if. There is hope if people fight. I'll tell you this. I don't know how this will sound, but it's what I believe. If the movie does not get a lot of views, if a lot of people don't see it, there's less hope.
Yeah.
This movie will give people hope. Wow, now we know what's going on.
That's
the point of the movie. Now you know what's going on.
Listen to my complete interview with Dennis Prager at townhallreview.com. Coming up, Larry Elder reacts to the latest nonsense from Beto O'Rourke.
My goodness, what an incredibly racist thing to say.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. I want to talk to you for a moment about ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. They really are the best and the brightest contending for the values we share. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Seth Leibson, filling in. Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke has witnessed his high hopes crash to the ground over the past couple months. And so, each chance he gets, he tries another extreme statement.
Anyone who does not and is caught in possession or seen in possession of one of these weapons of war, one of these instruments of terror, that weapon will be taken from them.
Not that he or any of the Democrats don't believe what Beto says, but rarely do they say these things out loud. Well, this week, he was at it again. Salem host Larry Elder explains.
Beto O'Rourke, he was talking about prison reform and about the so-called school-to-jail pipeline. You know, black kids graduate from school, and when they leave school, white guys with nets jump them and grab them and drag them off to jail. You know, the school-to-jail pipeline. He was asked about that, and he said, it all starts in the schools. And then he added, the teachers need to look like their students.
Let's move on to a list of solutions you drafted and proposed today with regards to prison reform. This is truly one of the biggest issues facing America today. To have, you know, the population of a small country imprisoned is something that has been a black mark on America's record for too long. Excuse the pun.
Right.
You have a large prison population in a country where it seems like the prison population is not going to dwindle anytime soon. What do you think needs to change beyond the obvious?
Right.
And how do you begin changing that?
You've got to stop this flow that really begins in school, and it doesn't begin in high school, this schoolhouse to jailhouse pipeline that we all hear about. It starts in kindergarten when a child is 5 years old. In Texas, that child is five times as likely to be disciplined or suspended or expelled if he or she is a child of color. That kid is absolutely defenseless against the system into which she was born. So making sure that we don't just have equality in terms of funding for our schools, but equity in our schools. Mm-hmm. The teachers should look like the students in front of them.
The teachers should look like the students in front of them. What an incredibly racist thing to say. So the reason black kids are disproportionately underperforming compared to white kids and Asian kids is because they don't have enough teachers who look like them in front of them. I had a teacher named Mr. Savage when I was in high school. He was white. He was a composition teacher. Who knew I couldn't learn from him? Another one named Mr. Longbottom also taught composition, told me I was a very good writer. I had no idea that he was not qualified to teach me because he and I are of different races. My goodness. My government teacher, Mr. Katzman, a Jew, who told me to raise my sights higher when I was applying to colleges and universities? Who knew he was unqualified to teach me? I had no idea. Unbelievable. When I was in school, I would say maybe 5% or so of the student body was Asian. I think we had one Asian teacher that I can think of. And yet, for the most part, the Asian kids were outperforming the black kids. Despite the fact that the teachers didn't look like them. How incredibly, incredibly insulting, demeaning, bigoted, condescending. This is the party that will not give inner city parents the option of saying, no, I don't want to send my kid to Larry Elder's former high school where only 3% of kids can do math at grade level. I want a private school voucher. No. Obama said, I've looked at the private school vouchers, and they don't work. And Bill O'Reilly said to him, I used to teach in the Catholic school system. I'm telling you, it works. And he talked about the D.C. Hope Scholarship Program, where every time the funding runs out, the Democrats try and shut it down, and then the parents go nuts, have press conferences, they relent, and continue the funding, because it's working. I'm not saying all charter schools, all private schools are the same. But when they have been measured, it turns out that kids that were underperforming in government schools, given an option because their parents want them out, the graduation rates are higher, parental satisfaction through the roof, reading test scores higher. And here Obama told Bill O'Reilly when he's running for office in 2008, I've looked at the D.C. Hope Scholarship Program and it is not working. It's not significantly raising their test scores, he said. Where did Sasha and Malia go? They went to a quality public school in Washington, D.C. Right? Wrong. Sidwell Friends. Same $40,000 a year prep school that Chelsea went to. Where did Obama himself go? To the finest prep school in the state of Hawaii, Punahou. And then 2 years at an elite private school in Los Angeles called Occidental. And then finished up his undergraduate education at an Ivy League school, Columbia, and then on to Harvard, where he graduated with a degree in law. How did he evade the school-to-jailhouse pipeline? And how many teachers did he have that looked like him?
Coming up,
there's a war on common sense.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Seth Leibson. If you were to bring anybody alive 100 years ago and teleport them to 2019, they'd think we've all gone mad. You could do this with anyone from 50 years ago, even 20. Most from 10 years ago would agree. Just look at the 50-plus gender options on Facebook and you get what I'm talking about. Robert Curry wrote a book titled Reclaiming Common Sense, Finding Truth in a Post-Truth World. And his book can add a new chapter every week. He joined Salem host Dennis Prager.
So I have a depressing question.
Okay, I'll try
Since,
to handle it.
Okay, good. Since Mark Twain said in the 1890s, common sense is not common, when you say reclaiming common sense, was there more in the past?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Good, go ahead.
In a number of senses, in frontier America, people really had to scramble and to survive and thrive, relying on common sense. I think it's one of the reasons that America got to be called the common sense nation. But there's more to it. The founders were brilliant students of a philosophy called common sense realism. And common sense realism was the defining fact of education in America for more than 100 years, depending on how you count it, up to almost the 20th century. So if you went, Lord Acton, you know, he's that wonderful man who said, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yep.
When he visited Harvard in the 1850s, what he found was that there weren't electives in those days. And Harvard juniors studied common sense realism.
Is that right? That was actually the name of the course or series of courses?
Yeah, well, that course was, I don't know, he didn't write, I read about it. He didn't write the name of the course, but it was a course in Thomas Reed, who was the father of common sense realism. So basically, you know, Alan Gelzo and Arthur Herman and others have pointed out that the philosophy of common sense realism was the official philosophy in the universities in America until that was overthrown around the beginning of the 20th century. So educated people were educated in the ideas of common sense realism, which means that, you know, common sense realism held that there are certain self-evident truths. And that founders were quoting.
By the way, I think a good example, a really, really, really powerful example, is that biological males can run against biological females if they say that they're a female. And I'm not saying I'm not saying it as a joke. I'm saying that is the classic example of the utter abandonment of common sense.
That's right. You and I grew up in the common sense reality that males are human beings are male or female, but there's a war on common sense, and one name for this war is an attempt to impose linguistic realism instead of common sense realism. So if a boy says he's a girl, he gets to use the girl's shower, he gets to compete with compete with girls in athletics. I mean, in other words, the idea is biological reality is trumped by what a person says about themselves. This is a direct attack on common sense.
Right. So here's my what I call $64,000 question, although with inflation, yes, it's $64 million. I have a question, and I don't know the answer to this fully. I have a theory, but on this one, I really want to know what you think. And that is, when you say it changed at the turn of the century, that is the 20th century when it began, what do you think happened at that time, generally speaking, to end common sense?
Well, the rise of American progressivism, American progressivism got going then, and it put Woodrow Wilson in the White House. Now, Wilson explicitly rejected the Constitution and the ideas of the Declaration of Independence. And the progressives have been in power more and more over the last century. They have two aims. One aim is to knock down the Constitution. You know, lately we're hearing about getting rid of the Electoral College and the First and Second Amendment. But the project of overthrowing the Constitution has been fundamental from the beginning. The other thing is Wilson and the progressives reject the idea that there are self-evident truths. Wilson was under the influence of this German philosopher named Hegel, who said that the ideas that we believe are only the ideas of our time. And so there's no such thing as truth except the truths of your historical period. So this is a big idea for one of the few ideas that Wilson really understood in a deep way. And the other progressives share that idea. So they don't believe that there's self-evident truth, which are the founding of the founding. and they don't believe in the Constitution and the Declaration. So they've set out to do two things. One, to overthrow that system, get rid of the Electoral College, etc. But also to attack the common sense that allows us to know that certain things are just true and are always going to be true. For example, human beings are male or female. That's a fundamental truth, and it needs to go. It needs to be rejected by political correctness, and that needs to be backed up by governmental power to force people not to think in simple terms of.
So, in effect, are you saying that progressivism and common sense are mutually exclusive?
Absolutely. And what they call themselves progressive then, but today, Dennis, you call them the left with a capital L. It's the same people. It's just that they've,
right, agreed.
They've come into ascendancy mm-hmm. in our time. The Democratic Party today is a progressive left party, a left party in your sense. And, you know, 100 years ago, it was an important wing of the party. It would come into dominance and then fall away.
I happen to agree. And by the way, in other words, that common sense leads you to a non-left perspective on life. It's
yes.
Common sense that the only way to stop a bad man with a gun is with a good man with a gun. But they reject. No, that's just yes. It's just that's just yes. Common sense. That's not pro-gun. Yes. It's pro-common sense.
Yes.
But they reject that as they do. I mean, capitalism is the only thing that has taken people out of poverty. So why would you, with common sense and love of humanity, ever advocate socialism? It produces no wealth. It's all common sense.
It's all common sense. In fact, in my opinion, I've made a big study of this, I think any point at which economics departs from common sense, these ideas that we can borrow our way out of debt and that kind of thing. Those ideas are not really economic ideas, but they're attacks on common sense within the economics profession.
To hear Dennis's complete conversation with Robert Curry, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up,
I'm absolutely at a loss about this.
Mike Gallagher on the big opioid settlement and the final segment of Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's The Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issues of the day. This week, Speaker Pelosi announces plans to actually formally pursue impeachment.
So what is at stake is our democracy.
Christian Outlook takes a closer look.
This is not a vote of impeachment. It is a vote on an impeachment inquiry.
And 1 year out from Election Day, a look at the field of candidates in this populist moment.
They haven't formed a winning coalition to date.
A look at the killing of the terrorist leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
He was driven by very clear theological convictions.
And a leader of mission to the Muslim world.
When you think of a major religion that assaults John 3:16, some of us just get angry for the glory of God.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to Town Hall Review. I'm Seth Liebson. The big drug companies have become a common target at the Democratic debates. How dare they make a profit by saving lives? But the opioid overdoses certainly have not helped the pharmaceutical cause. As a drug designed to help relieve pain has become horribly abused by doctors and patients alike, leading to thousands of deaths. And a recent lawsuit led to a settlement of over $250 million. Mike Gallagher reacts to the latest.
Drug abuse is an awful, awful thing. The opioid epidemic in America is real. I don't want to minimize it. I'm not trying to trivialize it. I've got a headline here that just is bothering me. And I saw this story last week. As you probably heard, there was a $260 million opioid settlement that involved large pharmaceutical companies and some counties in Ohio. The three major drug distributors and an opioid manufacturer have reached a $260 million settlement with two counties in Ohio. So in this settlement, the drug distributors agreed to pay $215 million to the two Ohio counties that brought the lawsuit. I don't know what the counties are going to do with $215 million. It's a lot of money. And now I'm seeing a headline that four state attorneys general are proposing a $48 billion opioid settlement between states, cities, tribes, and counties. But an attorney representing the cities and counties says the number isn't big enough. This would have been the first of many trials in which state and local governments are suing drug manufacturers for their role in the opioid crisis. Now, pharmaceutical companies manufacture drugs. If you become an opioid addict, can you tell me how that's the drug manufacturer's fault? If you live in a county in Ohio where there's a lot of people hooked on opioids, pain meds, let's say pain pills, can you explain to me why the drug manufacturer has to give that county $130 million? The pharmaceutical industry makes drugs that presumably make your life better. If you're in pain, if you've had surgery, if something terrible has happened to your body, you're going to want pain meds. In fact, now the opposite is happening. Doctors are terrified to prescribe pain meds. The doctors won't give you pain meds now because they don't want to be sued in case you become an addict. If you become an addict, why is that the doctor's fault? Why should the drug manufacturers be responsible for spending millions, maybe billions of dollars to the county where you're a drug addict? I'm at a loss on this one.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, and Michael Cook. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Seth Leibson. Thanks for joining us.